Sarah Rourke stood at the wheel of the fishing boat, glancing shoreward, trying to see if she could still locate Mr. Coyne in the darkness. She couldn't. Glancing back towards the stern, on the tarp that covered the blood from the dead soldier, she could see Michael and Annie, already dozing. She had dumped the body before picking them up along the beach.
It was rough, wasn't it, Mrs. Rourke?
My name is Sarah. Yes, it was rough, I suppose.
I saw them bloodstains. You had to kill somebody, didn't you?
I thought gentlemen didn't ask questions like that.
Well, I ain't a gentleman that much. You sure ain't either, Sarah.
What's that supposed to mean?
I'll just come right out with it. What you told me, I don't think it's fair to you or them kids going out and doing what you're doing. You need a man to take care of all of you. I guess I'm sort of volunteering. I like you. A lot, Sarah.
That's very sweet of you, Harmon.
Well, ain't sweet of me, Sarah. I mean what I say.
A lot of men feel that way about somebody who's helped them. Like a nurse, for example.
It ain't that.
Well, you just rest.
I'm sick of resting. Sick of this whole war. Whole damn thing.
So am I. I killed a man with a knife just a little bit ago. And my boy, Michael, killed a man. I've killed other people since the night of the war. We've been cold, sick, wet, dirty. We've gone without sleep. All of it.
I hear that northeastern Canada didn't get hit much. The fella I met had come down from there. Missed the commies all the way. New York City, he heard, was all gone. But up there in northeastern Canada, it was still like before. Ain't nothing there that the communists would want, I guess. Too cold. But a man could have a good life up there. And with the right woman. With kids like them.
How far is the island?
You still on the compass heading I worked out?
Uh-huh.
Maybe 20 minutes or so. Just keep them running lights out so the patrol boats don't spot us. I figure we could take this boat and make it pretty far up into Canada. Leave all this behind us.
What about the resistance? The men in prison you told me about?
I don't know. Don't guess I'll help them by getting myself killed. I did my share. Sounds like you've done your share too since the war began.
My husband is out there somewhere, looking for us.
You don't know that. He might be dead. If he is alive, I figure you and the kids were dead. Maybe took up with another woman.
Maybe. Maybe all of that. But if he's alive, he's looking for me. And the only thing that's keeping me going is telling myself he's alive.
What if I tell you he's dead, probably? Or what if I tell you he's so busy staying alive himself that he can't look for you?
What if the war never happened?
How come he was away from you when it happened? None of my business, I know that, but how come?
We'd been separated. Nothing formal. Just couldn't get along the past few years. He came back just before the war. We made up, decided to try it again. It was my fault, really. He wanted to cancel the job he had in Canada and stay home. I told him I needed time to get my head clear, to think, so we could start again. The night the war happened, he should have been on his way back.
Driving?
No, by air.
Ain't nothing left of Atlanta, Sarah, if he landed there. I heard lots of commercial airliners crash when they ran out of fuel with nowhere to land or just got blown out of the sky when they flew too close to a missile or an airburst. He's dead. Got to be.
You don't know my husband, Harmon. He isn't like anyone you've ever met.
Some kind of super guy or something?
In a way, I guess he is. You can see it in Michael. I wouldn't have expected a boy twice Michael's age to do what he's done. It's not normal.
What do you mean?
John Rourke is... He's always been so much larger than life. He's almost perfect, really. He seems to know everything. To be able to do anything. To solve any problem. He isn't like you or me.
Paul Rubenstein glanced at his wristwatch. Running in a low crouch, he started out of the palms and toward the first of the 10-foot chain-link fences, the Schmeisser slung from his right shoulder, the wire cutters in his left hand. As he reached the fence, he dropped into a deeper crouch, glancing quickly from side to side. Starting at the bottom of the fence, he clipped upward, approximately 4 feet high. Because of the heaviness of the wire, another cut was needed. He cut horizontally across the top of the first cut, then pulled the wire mesh outward toward him, slipping through in the darkness and pulling his newly created gate closed behind him. He glanced toward the guard towers, then hit the dirt, flattening himself, the Schmeisser out in his right hand. A searchlight beam crossed over the ground less than a foot away from him. The searchlight moved on, and so did Rubenstein, running across the grassy area, zigzagging just in case there was a minefield, hoping by some miracle he would miss them all by not running in a straight line. He reached the opposite fence line, breathless again. He started to reach his hand toward it, then stopped, his hand recoiling. There was a rat on the ground, less than a foot from him, the body half burned.
Electrified.
Rubenstein glanced from side to side, quickly trying to determine whether to go back or whether there was some other way to cross the fence. He snatched at the big Gerber knife and started digging in the mixed dirt and sand. He couldn't go through the fence, couldn't go over it, so he'd go under it. He glanced up, flattening himself on the ground, almost touching the fence with his bare hand. The searchlight moved down the center of the open space between the fences, missing him by inches. As soon as it passed, keeping himself as low to the ground as possible, he began again to dig. For once, he was grateful he wasn't as big or as broad-shouldered as Rourke. He scooped dirt with his hands, widening the hole under the fence. The searchlight was making another pass, and he flattened himself to the ground, as close to the fence as possible. This time, noticing the searchlight that scanned more frequently and more rapidly the ground between this fence and the interior fence. That, at least, was not electrified. Within the hour, all the prisoners in the compound had been herded inside the tents under which they were sheltered, and the compound grounds were empty of life. But earlier, he had seen hands, faces, all touching that fence. It was possible, he thought, as he began again to dig, that the smaller fence was electrified after the compound was cleared, but he had to take the chance. The small trench under the fence seemed wide enough now, and slipping into position, just missing another pass of the searchlight, he started through on his back, feet first. His shirt pulled out of his pants, and he felt the dirt against the skin at the small of his back. The front of Rubenstein's shirt was stuck on a barb in the lowest strand of wire. Perhaps there was no power in the lowest strand, he thought. Perhaps the material in the shirt just hadn't made the right contact. He didn't know. He sucked his stomach in, lest his skin touch the barb. Rubenstein looked from side to side, past the fence and back toward his feet, seeing the searchlight starting again. It would pass over his feet, reveal his presence. There was a sick feeling inside of him, his mind racing to find a way out. He had to gamble, he thought. He touched, gingerly, with his shirt-sleeved elbow at the wire. Nothing happened. Rubenstein reached out with both hands, freeing the shirt from the barb, then pushed through under the wire, the searchlight sweeping over the ground as he moved into a shadow. The young man got his feet under him, remaining in a crouch. He stared back at the wire a moment, then reached into the pockets of his leather jacket. There was nothing he could use, but he had to know. Taking the wire cutters, he reached under the fence's lowest strand, using the cutters like a slave hand in a laboratory, picking up the dead rat and sliding it under the fence toward him. He looked at the charred creature, and his mouth turned down at the corners in disgust. He hated the things. He lifted the rat with the tips of the cutters and tossed the already dead body against the wire, second from the bottom of the fence.
Thank God.
Rubenstein was at the third fence. Looking over his shoulder, the wire cutters in his left hand now, he folded back the fence section and started through the third fence into the compound. He clutched the pistol grip of the Schmeisser in his right fist, the muzzle moving from side to side as he surveyed the compound. He could see a guard, one only, walking slowly around the grounds, 50 yards from where he was. About 20 yards ahead of him was the flap of the nearest tent.
Oh, my God.
Rubenstein stopped, the smell assailing his nostrils, nauseating him. A buzzing sound in the air as flies swarmed throughout the tent. He looked in the faces of the people under the glow of the single yellow light hanging from a drop cord in the center of the tent, the flies and moths buzzing close to it. The faces were young, old, all of them weary, some of them sleeping, flies crawling across them. There was a child lying with eyes wide open beside a sleeping woman. He stepped closer to them, and he realized the child was not breathing. Rubenstein stood there a moment, tears welling up in his eyes, his glasses steaming a little. In that instant, he was thankful for the guns he carried, for the things he'd learned that had kept him from a similar fate. He was grateful to Rourke for teaching him how to survive after the night of the war. Rubenstein moved from tent to tent after having fought the urge to throw up once he'd gotten outside the first tent. The success of that effort had probably saved his life, and he was now even more careful to avoid silhouetting himself against any light. He had talked to a half dozen men and women, skeletal figures that paid more attention to swatting flies than the questions of a man they thought was just a fellow prisoner. The lights were kept on in the tents to make certain no one stood up during the night, and to make visual inspection of the tents easier when the guards looked in. There were no sanitary facilities, no facilities for care of the sick or the children, and some of the guards, Rubenstein had learned, enjoyed beating people. Other guards had seemed like decent men, but did nothing when their colleagues abused the detainees. But no one Paul spoke to had ever heard of retired Air Force Colonel David Rubenstein or his wife, Rebecca. Paul stopped at another tent, the fifth so far. The stench in this tent was either not so bad or he had become accustomed to it. He wasn't sure which. There were more children here, faces drawn, eyes sunken, bellies swollen. He had been told that most of the older people gave the bulk of their food to the children and the recent mothers, and the food allotment for each adult per day was a cup of cereal, as much bad water as you wanted to drink, and twice a week, fish or meat. The cereal had weevils in it. The fish and meat usually smelled rancid. A lot of the people around the camp had dysentery. Rubenstein passed through the tent, looking for his parents, looking for a familiar face, not sure if he'd recognize any of his parents' friends. There was a woman at the far end of the tent.
Who are you?
My name is Paul Rubenstein.
Why are you here?
I'm looking for my parents. Do you know them? My father has a full head of white hair. His first name is David. My mother's first name is Rebecca. Rubenstein. He was a colonel in the Air Force before he retired.
He wouldn't be here then.
How do you know?
He just wouldn't be here. I was supposed to be someplace else too, but I was pregnant and they didn't want me along, so they left me. I lost the baby. I don't know what they did with my baby afterward. They never told me. He was a boy. Reggie would have been proud of his son. Handsome. Reggie's in the Air Force, too. That's why they took him. Some kind of special camp near Miami for military people. I hope they don't hurt Reggie. I would have named my baby Reggie Jr. after my husband. He was a beautiful boy.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what they did with him.
I'm sorry.
I would have named him Reggie. You know?
Rubenstein could see a tiny knife edge of sunlight, a reddish tinge on the horizon. The camp would soon be awake, and he had to get out before he got caught. He looked back toward the tent, thinking of all the lost souls it held. He was going to go to Miami. He would find his parents at whatever hellhole camp they were in, if they were still alive. But first, he was going to do something here. He didn't know what yet. There was the Army intelligence contact. Maybe he could help. Paul pulled himself back against the tent. He looked to his right. There was a U.S. military jeep coming, three Cubans riding in it. He pushed his glasses back from the bridge of his nose and brushed his thinning black hair back from his high forehead. Paul Rubenstein raised himself to his feet, standing almost directly in front of the jeep, the headlights beaming just to his left.
¿Qué es esto?
You bastards! The driver of the jeep slumped forward across the wheel. Then the man beside him, the third man in the back, raising a pistol to fire. Rubenstein ran beside the jeep just as the vehicle swerved off at a crazy angle toward one of the tents. The young man jumped for it, his left foot on the running board, his right hand loosing the Schmeisser, pushing the dead driver from behind the wheel. Sliding in, he kicked the dead man's feet away from the pedals.
Everyone, look! Someone's trying to escape!
People streamed from their tents as Rubenstein skidded the jeep around, fumbling the transmission into first. He could see the guards running toward him from the far end of the camp. Some of the prisoners of the camp threw themselves toward the advancing Cuban guards. Rubenstein ejected the magazine on the Schmeisser with his left hand, replacing it with a fresh one. He rested the blue-black submachine gun along the dashboard, pointing it through the shattered windshield. There were dozens of guards, he thought, all of them armed with assault rifles or pistols, streaming from metal huts. Most were only half-dressed. He glanced to his left. There was a communist Cuban guard running beside the jeep, hands outstretched, reaching for him. Rubenstein balanced the steering wheel with his left knee, snatching the wire cutters from his belt. The Cuban soldier fell, the wire cutters embedded in his chest. Rubenstein stomped the clutch and upshifted, the jeep now speeding past the tents, the huts, the angry guards, and their guns. He saw a man who looked like an officer go down. Rubenstein hoped he was the camp commandant. He dropped the empty Schmeisser beside him on the front seat, then snatched the worn blue Browning High Power into his right fist. His round split the face of a Cuban soldier who'd thrown himself up on the hood of the Jeep. Rubenstein fought the wheel of the Jeep with his left hand, bringing the vehicle into a sharp left turn, the Jeep almost flipping over on him as he gunned it forward. Holding the pistol upwardly, he rammed the stick into third gear. Two Cuban soldiers were running for him, the gate 100 yards ahead. Rubenstein rammed the Browning straight out in his right hand. The nearer of the two men threw his hands to his face as he fell. The second man, unhit, dove into the Jeep, his hands reaching out for Rubenstein's throat. Rubenstein tried bringing the gun up to fire, but the man was in the way, his hands tightening around Rubenstein's throat as the Jeep swerved out of control. Rubenstein dropped the Browning, clawing at the Cuban's face, getting his fingers into the man's mouth by the left cheek, then ripping as hard as he could. The man's face split on the left side, the fingers released from Rubenstein's throat, and Rubenstein grasped the 9mm pistol. Rubenstein cut the wheel right just in time, the left fender crashing into a row of packing crates that tumbled into the mud. The high power clenched in his right fist, Rubenstein cut the wheel harder right, with less than 50 yards to go until he reached the main gate. A dozen guards stood by the gate, shooting at him. Paul jammed the Browning high power into his trouser band, then fumbled on the seat for the Schmeisser. He balanced the steering wheel with his left knee again, as he changed sticks in the submachine gun. He brought the muzzle of the weapon up over the hood, his left fist locking on the wheel again. The distance to the gate was now 35 yards. He hoped he remembered what Rourke had told him about practical firing range. 25 yards. 15.
Now!
Rubenstein cut the wheel into a sharp right as he tore out onto the open road. As he sped past the concentration camp, Rubenstein looked to his right. He could see men, women, and children. He imagined he even saw the young woman who had lost her baby. Their numbers now outweighed the number of guards, and they overpowered the armed men and ran for every opening they could find, yelling and waving their arms in the air. They were free. Natalia stood under the shower, the hot water feeling good as it splashed on her skin and ran down her body. It was not easy to wash away memories and images, she realized. She grabbed a towel and wrapped it around her hair, then another towel and wrapped it around her body. Her feet were still slightly wet as she walked out of the bathroom and across the carpeted bedroom. She stepped out onto the small balcony overlooking the sea. She was disappointed that she had missed the sunrise. It had been a disappointing night as well, one she wanted quickly to forget. She now understood why Diego Santiago needed to aggressively pursue a woman. She didn't think that she was the reason he got overexcited. She suspected it was a problem that he had with every woman. He had cursed, apologized, of course, then fallen silent. She had kissed him and tried to soothe him afterward. She felt that despite the problem, or perhaps because of it, he now trusted her, relying on her to keep a guilty secret. She had washed her body 3 times, but the memory of the premature end of the encounter still lingered. She would normally have felt sympathy for a man in this situation, but the contrast with the earlier memory of Santiago's manly posturing made his outward behavior into a bigger lie than she could stomach. The macho general was truly more like an inexperienced and overcompensating boy. In truth, she was glad nothing had happened with him, because she hadn't wanted it to. In her time with Vladimir Karamazov, she had sometimes used her body to gain information, but she had never liked doing it, even though he had told her he would not blame her for whatever she did in the line of duty. When Santiago kissed her, she had thought only of Rourke and wished it were him. She knew that with Rourke, it would have been so much different.
John.
She hugged her arms about her against the chill of the wind, looking skyward, thinking it was perhaps going to rain. Rourke had killed Karamazov, but he had done it for her, as her uncle had explained it. Should she keep the vow she'd made to kill Rourke? Could she? The uncertainty inside was destroying her, but more than ever now, she knew she loved the American. She wondered, absently, if he had yet found his wife and children. Somehow it would be easier to know he was with them. Then he would have no reason to think of her, and she would know for herself that he was out of reach. Natalia smiled, thinking of Rourke, sensing how strong his feelings were for his family. She could successfully face and defeat adversaries in this world, but she knew that if she tried to fight something that lived only in Rourke's heart, she could never win. John Rourke downed half the tumbler of whiskey, looked at his watch, then walked from the table to the curtained window. He squinted against the sunlight. There were dark clouds on the horizon, but above them the sun was bright. He walked back across the room again, snapping off the lamp which had illuminated the table through the night and early morning. He looked at Chambers, then at Sissy Wisneski.
I don't know which one of them is the communist agent. The information in their files is too ambiguous.
It's all we have.
I know that. I trust Reed. I don't think he's the traitor. Couldn't be just a small fish. Gotta be somebody with access to practically everything you do.
But if there's a traitor, why haven't they attacked here?
To mount a full-scale attack here would be time-consuming, expensive, and use a lot of troops the Russians can't spare. As long as they have President Chambers under a microscope, know his every move, it doesn't bother them. It's almost better than capturing him. If they captured him, somebody else would assume the leadership function, and they'd be in the dark as to what US-2 is planning on doing. This way, they know everything. Once we find the traitor, it'll be a different story. I think this area will be too hot for you, Mr. President. You'll have to leave here, go into hiding somewhere else. Sissy, this traitor, whoever he is the reason they've left this place alone. In a pinch, they could probably have used the spy to have assassinated the president anyway. Get the best of both worlds. The KGB people aren't fools enough to cut off their nose to spite their face.
But you're sure there's a traitor here, Rourke?
There has to be. There's only one way I can see to flush him out, too. The best ruse is no ruse at all. I want you to call an emergency meeting.
A straightforward approach? Not exactly politics as usual. Maybe you should be president, Mr. Rourke. I'd have voted for you.
I have better things to do, sir.
Sarah Rourke stood on the beach, the blanket over her shoulders, her body still cold. Harmon Kleinschmidt's arm also was around her shoulders, to support himself as he stood, she told herself. Michael and Annie were standing a few feet in front of her. She glanced over her shoulder at the fishing boat beached in the surf. She turned back to look up the beach toward the rocks beyond. She'd been following the movement there for some time, and now, finally, the people who had been watching her were coming down.
Here they come, Sarah.
She only nodded, watching. Unarmed, Sarah took a step forward, Kleinschmidt moving beside her. About 24 women were walking across the beach, some of them holding pistols, some with rifles. One woman had a baby suckling her left breast, and she held a pistol in her right hand. There were children, too, about Michael and Annie's ages, and most of the women looked young.
Mama? Who are they?
It's all right, Michael. Here are children for you and Annie to play with. You'll see.
She saw Michael staring at Kleinschmidt, the dark eyes boring into the man who had an arm around her shoulders. Michael's jaw was set, just like John's was so often.
See, Sarah? Told you there'd be someone to keep your kids company while we wait here.
Wait?
I want you to come with me to Canada, Sarah. I mean that. I'll convince you I'm right.
Hey, Harmon!
Hey, Mary Beth. This here's Sarah. The children are Michael and Annie. Good kids, too.
I'll get somebody to take the boat out and scuttle her.
No, you don't. I'm just a taxi service. Harmon was wounded. I brought him here. I hope nobody minds if I stay for a while, let my children rest a little. But then, I'm leaving.
We're both leaving.
Then you get it down into the shallows along the beach there. Get her moored and camouflage it. Them Russians see a boat here, they're gonna come looking for us for sure.
Agreed.
Come on, then. I'll give you a hand and watch the kids. Some of the girls here can help you with Harmon, getting him up to the cave. Then I guess we can all give you a hand with the boat. Come on.
See, Sarah, it's gonna be fine.
Sarah just looked at Harmon. He was the only fully grown man on the island and couldn't take more than 2 steps without someone holding him up. She shook her head, shivering a little, thinking it was not going to be fine at all. John Rourke waited in the shadows by the corner of the building, watching. Chambers had called the emergency meeting without announcing Rourke's arrival. He did reveal the presence of Sissy Wisneski. Chambers had announced to his advisors that disaster in Florida was imminent. He told them nothing that had to do with Rourke's plan to flush the traitor. Prior to the meeting, Chambers had selected 11 men, Rourke making the 12th. The 11 men had been chosen from Army intelligence, men Chambers knew Reed personally trusted. The meeting finally broke up. Rourke waited. On mere chance, he had selected to follow Randon Soames, commander of the Texas Volunteer Militia. Each of the other men would also follow one of the advisors. Rourke had determined that if someone left the compound, it would be almost a dead giveaway that this person was the traitor. As he studied the compound, looking for some sign of Soames, Rourke wished the problem were merely as simple as finding the traitor. But once the traitor was recognized, it would be necessary to follow him to his contact, his radio, whatever means he used to notify the Soviets. It was through that chain that Rourke could contact Varikov. Already, time was running out, and there was little hope of an evacuation, however limited. Rourke turned up the collar of his coat, the wind cold on his back. He'd left the pistol belt with the Python and the CAR-15 with his bike. As he closed the leather jacket, he checked the twin Detonix 45s in the double Alessi rig under the coat. They were secure, with spare magazines for the pistols in his trouser belt in friction retention speed pouches. Rourke hunkered back into the niche in the wall beside which he stood, then spotted Randon Soames, dressed in a pair of Levi's, a black Stetson, and a Western-style plaid shirt, walking across the compound toward the gates. It was almost too easy, Rourke thought. Rourke took off at a dead run after him, stopping when he reached the gates, nodding to the guard and looking down the road. Soames was walking. Rourke turned to the guard. Both the intelligence people and the MPs were under the command of Captain Reed.
Did he say where he was going, Corporal?
You're Mr. Rourke, aren't you?
That's right, son.
No, sir. Mr. Soames is just going for a walk, I guess. He does that a lot, but so do some of the others.
How long is he usually gone?
Maybe half an hour. On foot, the only place he could make in that amount of time and get back would be the town. It's abandoned now. There wouldn't be time for him to do anything except turn around and walk right back.
He always walked that way?
Leastways, every time I've seen him, sir.
Thanks, Corporal.
Rourke started down the road after Soames, hugging the compound wall until the man disappeared over the rise. Then he started running to catch up, getting to the rise and stopping to crouch down beside the road. Randon Soames wasn't walking quickly, wasn't turning around, nothing suspicious. Maybe he really was just going for a walk. For a man his age, he looked reasonably fit, and riding a desk all day could make any man antsy. He watched Soames pass over the next rise. There wasn't even a weapon visible. Rourke couldn't see anyone going out these days unarmed unless he were a complete fool. Rourke came to the top of the next rise, catching sight of Soames as he finally looked behind him, then pushed his way into a stand of trees. Rourke watched, waiting, thinking that a radio might be concealed in the trees there. But as Rourke started to push himself up to move over the rise toward the trees, Soames reappeared, pushing a small motorcycle. It was a small Honda, the kind that had been made years earlier and designed for compactness. He remembered reading about the small cycle. The handlebars folded down for easy storage. Top speed was about 35 miles per hour. Soames looked from side to side along the road, then mounted the cycle. He was headed down the road toward the abandoned town. Rourke realized now how Soames made it appear he had no time to do anything other than walk down to the town and back. It had to be risky keeping the cycle stowed there, Rourke thought. But being a spy was not exactly safe either, he knew. There was nothing to do now but run. Rourke pushed himself to his feet. He wished he'd somehow had the foresight to stash his own motorcycle nearby, or that he could risk a radio call in and get transportation. But he had no idea what frequency Soames' Soviet contact might be on, and he had eschewed the use of a radio. He had to gamble that Soames would be headed for the town and would stay on or near the road. Rourke knew from the map he had studied earlier that the road zigzagged, following the terrain, and Rourke ran cross-country now to get ahead of Soames. He skidded down a low embankment, rolling behind some scrub brush low against the ground, the road below him as Soames moved along it on the small bike. As Soames passed, Rourke pushed himself up, running across the road and into the grassy field beyond, not daring to lose sight of Randon Soames. Rourke dove half into a ditch along the roadside as Soames rounded a curve. Soames looked behind him, then from side to side. Rourke peered through the tall grass as Soames continued down the road and into the town. Rourke pushed himself up, jumping the ditch into the road, then crossing it. He reached the building at the nearest edge of the abandoned town. The town limit sign was down, but he estimated from the buildings and the streets that it had been a town of 3,000 or 4,000 before the night of the war. He peered around the corner of the abandoned fire station behind which he stood, watching as Soames turned the motorcycle down the street at the farthest edge of the town. Rourke jogged past the first block, running across the intersecting street. He then passed broken store windows, a mailbox knocked over apparently by a car in haste to evacuate the city, and other detritus. He reached the next intersection, glanced down it to make certain Soames wasn't suckering him, hadn't doubled back. Rourke leaned against the side of a corner building, a real estate development firm, then peered around the corner. His heart sank for a moment. Soames was nowhere in sight, but at the end of the street, approximately two blocks down, was an uncharacteristically elaborate athletic field and stadium. Rourke stared at it. The stadium looked to have cost more than all the other buildings in the town combined. Rourke snatched one of the twin Detonix pistols from the Alessi shoulder holster. He hugged the side of the buildings he passed, getting across the alley, then to the next street and into the next block. He slowed, the athletic field less than 200 yards away. And beyond the cinder track, with some of the painted white lines in the field still visible, was the stadium. Something inside Rourke told him Soames was there. He snatched the second Detonix from under his right arm into his left hand. Rourke examined the dust on the concrete surface outside the stadium entrance. Faintly, he could detect a tire tread in the blown sand. As Rourke reached the end of the tunnel, he scanned the bowl of the stadium itself, squinting against the sunlight despite the dark glasses he wore. Apparently, the games held at the stadium had once been broadcast over local radio. There was a low-gain antenna beside the booth on the far top side of the arena, the sort of antenna that could be used to transmit to a more powerful receiver sender 50 miles or so away. There was no sign of Soames or his bike. Rourke walked up the low, broad concrete steps into the grandstand. He started along the circumference of the stadium toward the booth and the antenna. One Detonix 45 in each hand, Rourke moved slowly ahead, looking from side to side. He no longer cared if Soames detected his presence, because there was nowhere the spy could go. Soames could smash his radio, but that was unlikely. Rather than going cold, out of contact with his Soviet masters, he'd likely try to make a fight of it. Perhaps Soames had weapons stashed somewhere in the stadium. Perhaps there had been a weapon concealed on his body, a holster that carried a snubby revolver or medium-frame automatic in the top of his cowboy boot. It didn't matter in any event. Rourke stopped beside the broadcast booth. The antenna was corroded, weather-stained, but a new-looking, almost shiny coax cable ran from it, through what seemed to be a freshly drilled hole in the concrete below the grandstand. Rourke turned around, his eyes searching for the nearest steps down into the stadium complex beneath the stands. He stopped at the head of the steps, both pistols in front of him, elbows tucked close to his sides. Rourke began walking along the tunnel, hugging his body against the rough concrete wall, the pistol in his right hand held high, the one in his left held flat along his left thigh. In the shadows, Rourke spotted the darker blackness of the new coax cable leading down from above, then snaking ahead into the tunnel and toward its end.
Why worry? All that damn earthquake's gonna do is kill more Americans, kill a bunch of them dang Cubans. I didn't think your people gave a shit about them anyway.
What ways to come, but you are wrong. We must contact headquarters. This is an important development. There may be valued Soviet personnel working in Florida at this very moment. They, at least, must be gotten out. It is not your responsibility, nor is it mine, to determine who lives and dies. You speak of a disaster which could take millions of lives. Do you wish this on your conscience?
As Rourke's eyes adjusted to the darkness, he identified Soames' motorcycle just a few feet away. He shoved the Detonix from his right hand into his trouser band, then selected the Safariland stainless handcuff key from his key ring, placing it at the valve stem on the rear tire. Pocketing the key ring, Rourke snatched the Detonix from his belt again. A pistol in each hand once more, he sidestepped the bike, then pressed against the concrete tunnel wall and moved ahead again.
Well, go on then and call Varikov or whoever. But let him know that I brought it to you.
You're still worried that General Varikov will come for you, perhaps in the middle of the night, and kill you for molesting a child. Maybe you're right. He does not like your perversion, and he knows that you are afraid of him.
Shut up.
I'll go along with that, Soames. Both of you shut up.
Who are...
Move, and I kill you.
Soames started for the radio. Suddenly, Vaskovich was coming toward him, a pistol in his right hand. Vaskovich's gun discharged, and Rourke could feel the heat as he smacked the Detonix across the KGB man's neck.
The radio! Soames! Smash it!
Rourke kicked Vaskovich's gun hand, then spotted Soames staggering away from the far wall, a pistol in his right hand aimed at the radio. Rourke tried bringing his right hand into position to shoot, but Vaskovich shoved against him. Rourke backhanded one of the detonics across the man's face. The slugs threw the Texas commander back. Rourke wheeled right. The KGB man was recovering, trying to raise his pistol to fire. No time to swing his guns online, Rourke dropped them and hurled himself sideways. His left hand reached for the KGB man's gun hand, the right hand going for the throat. Rourke, for the first time, noticed the KGB officer's pistol, a Detonics 45 like his own, but blued. Rourke slammed the KGB man's gun hand down. Rourke moved his hand from the Russian's throat and smashed his right fist across the man's jaw. The Russian's head snapped back, and Rourke moved up on his haunches. Rourke studied the man's eyes. The lids were closed, not fluttering. Rourke touched his fingers to the Russian's neck. He raised the head slightly. However he'd hit the man, the neck had snapped and the Russian was dead. He hadn't wanted that. Rourke thumbed on the safety of the KGB man's blued Detonics pistol and tucked the pistol into his belt, intending to keep it. He found his own pistols, then walked the few steps to Soames. Despite three hits from Rourke's 45s, the paramilitary leader was still breathing. Gently, Rourke rolled Soames over. The wounds would make him die, but not for several minutes if his constitution was strong, Rourke determined.
Soames, how do you make your contacts?
Go to hell.
I can either let you die comfortably or painfully, Soames. You know I'm a doctor. I've got a small emergency kit under my coat. I can give you a shot. Morphine? Sound good? You could linger for hours.
Ignoring Soames, Rourke took the blue Detonics that had belonged to the KGB man and studied it, dumping the half-spent magazine, clearing the chamber. The pistol was in pristine condition, still wearing the original checkered walnut grips. He made a mental note to check the body and the room for spare magazines, which were interchangeable with his own guns.
Well, Soames, you die in pain or get the morphine shot?
Give me that shot.
The radio first. Tell me how to make contact. I try it, it works, then you get the shot.
All right. Songbird to Condor 1. Request. Request relay.
What relay?
Request relay 19. That gets you through.
Thanks, asshole.
Rourke walked over to the radio. He assumed they were using English on the radio. That way, if the signal were intercepted, it would attract less attention. Rourke picked up the microphone, staring at it a moment, then at the men to whom the radio had been so important.
Songbird to Condor 1, requesting Relay 19, over. Songbird to Condor 1, requesting Relay 19, over.
Relay 19 through Condor 1, stand by.
Oh, I'm not going anywhere.
Sarah Rourke lay naked under her blanket, trying to warm herself and rid her bones of the chill she'd felt ever since the swim that previous night. Harmon Kleinschmidt was sleeping farther back in the cave, in what seemed like an additional chamber. Some of the women were half undressed. Apparently, none of them worried that Harmon would wake up and see them.
Harmon maybe is doing the right thing.
What do you mean, Mary Beth?
We're going up to Canada. All our men are going to be dead by tomorrow afternoon. Some army intelligence fella that brings us supplies was out and left just before you and Harmon got here. He says the execution is on for tomorrow, to show the resistance what'll happen if they keep up fighting.
Aren't you going to try to do something to save your husbands? Your boyfriends?
Like what, lady?
Like a rescue attempt.
Kleinschmidt can't do nothing. He's gonna be laid up for a long time.
Well, we don't necessarily need a man to do it. We could do it ourselves.
We?
I meant the women, not me personally. Women could rescue them. You don't need a man to lead you.
You volunteering?
Well, I don't really know of any...
What I thought. Wind is all.
All right.
All right what?
All right, I'll do it. If you need someone to lead it, I'll do it.
What?
I'll do it.
Sarah stood up. She felt foolish suddenly and started toward the far end of the cave to find dry clothes. It was no time to lounge around talking with the girls. Somehow that made her feel foolish now. Now that she had committed, she knew she would have to go through with it. She could only wish, though, that she knew how.
This is John Rourke. Tell General Varikov I want to speak with him. It's important, more important than he could realize. Get me Varikov immediately.
One moment.
Oh, come on, God damn it.
This is Varikov. Rourke? Rourke, are you there?
This is Rourke, General. Can we speak freely?
I suppose so.
I have what I think you will agree is grievous news. And frankly, I need your help.
My help?
Yes, General. Because I think I understand you and I respect you. So I need your help.
State your request, Rourke. I will only promise to listen.
Rourke started at the beginning, what Sissy Wisneski had told him regarding the artificially created fault line that would very soon precipitate the earthquake, which would sever Florida from the U.S. mainland, and about the hundreds of thousands of lives that would be lost.
Maybe I have you figured wrong, but I don't think so. Can you help?
This is all true? You give me your word on this thing?
To the best of my knowledge, General, yes.
You have seen this seismographic evidence with your own eyes?
One sheet. The rest was lost with her bike.
You are a man of science. This is possible?
I think so.
You ask that I make a truce between your US 2 forces and the Soviets?
Temporary, of course.
Of course. What about the Cubans? You seriously think that they will believe you, or me, for that matter?
If we can get them to take it seriously enough, they'll evacuate themselves, I suppose. Then your people and mine can move in and evacuate the civilians.
Why should I do this thing?
Honestly, General, I don't know, but I have a feeling that you and I agree that too many innocent people have already died. I'm guessing that you'll help me prevent more needless deaths.
You think that I will?
Yes. If you can, I think that you will.
Natalia is there, on a mission with Colonel Miklov to negotiate with the Cubanos over a few minor difficulties. I can contact her, have her break the news to the Cuban commander. But you must do two things first.
What's that?
I think this Wisneski woman with this strange first name must go to Florida, show the piece of paper, talk to the Cuban commander. And perhaps you should go too. If this is necessary, you will also promise me that you will not board the plane to evacuate until Major Chavarovna has boarded as well. Agreed?
Why do you ask that?
She will stay to help in the evacuation. You know that.
I suppose Natalia would. All right. I agree. I will not leave without her. And I suppose it would be necessary for the girl to go there. But as soon as the Cubans are convinced, I must be put in contact with your emergency commanders and the Cubans. I have someone in Florida, too. My friend Paul Rubinstein is there now. I'm not certain exactly where.
The Jew? I think I know. We thought at first you were with him. I recently received an intelligence report on a single-handed attack on a Cuban detention camp. The young man fought like a lion, and most of the internees at the camp were Jews. It must be Rubinstein. Yes, we will help you to find him, in exchange for your shepherding Major Chemerovna.
Major? She was a captain.
She is being promoted, for bravery. You understand?
Yes, General. How do we contact each other? I can bring this radio to headquarters with me.
Yes. I would speak with this Mr. Chambers and arrange the details of the truce.
Did I kill Soames, the child molester?
Yes. And I assume...
Your man Veskovich was very brave, and he died well. If he had a family...
I will see that they know. Goodbye for now, Rourke.
John Rourke sat there by the yellow light, not saying anything, not thinking anything. There was a picture now, vivid in his mind, and he almost wanted it to go away. It was an indefinite and changing picture, sometimes a face, sometimes a way of standing or walking, and sometimes, if a voice could be pictured, it was a voice. Natalia. They were to meet again, he knew.
The fact is, General Santiago, that if these misdirected actions of your line commanders near the border continue, it will do nothing to further the cause of harmonious relations between your people and ours.
But according to the reports of my line commanders, Colonel Mikloff, there have been no such incidents beyond the course of normal patrolling or pursuit of an escaping resistance fighter and the like. There have been no intentional incursions into your country's space.
But, General Santiago, you must realize that whatever the cause for border incursions, they do little to promote harmonious relations. It is my hope that such incursions can be stopped completely. This is my purpose here, to discuss these matters and work out a mutually equitable solution.
Mikloff leaned back from across the table, seemingly studying the Cuban commander's face across the highly polished wood separating them. Natalia had played tennis often before the night of the war, but she had always more enjoyed watching it well played by two worthwhile adversaries. As she turned her head now to look at Santiago, she felt a similar feeling. It was up to Santiago, either to volley the ball Mikloff had served or lose the match. Natalia began to turn to Santiago to see his response, but then her eyes drifted across the room to a white-coated, dark-skinned steward entering the room. The man stopped beside Santiago and placed a silver tray on the table before him. Santiago unfolded a note on the tray, then nodded to the steward.
My dear Captain Tiermarovna, there is a radio telephone message for you. You may take it on the telephone in your room if you wish.
Thank you, Comrade General.
Natalia swept past the end of the table, touching the fingers of her left hand to Santiago's epauletted shoulder as she walked by. Natalia crossed the room, feeling Santiago's eyes on her, then crossed through the doorway, closing the door behind her. She stopped, leaning back against the door a moment, looking down at the carpet beneath her feet. The caller had to be Varakov. She pushed away from the door and started toward the stairs, running up to the second floor of the house, then to her room. Natalia walked inside. Sitting on the edge of the bed, she smoothed her skirt under her.
Tiamarovna.
Natalia, it's your uncle. Listen very carefully. Rourke called me. The news he had was important. He used one of our own radio receivers. That is not important, though. Listen carefully.
Paul Rubinstein, the sun glaring down on him, his legs tensed, realized that he'd been bawling his fists open and closed. The last few days had been as stressful as any since the war, and the red-faced, beer-bellied man hunched over the boat in front of him wasn't making things any easier.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about, fella.
Captain Reed gave me your name, Tolliver. He said you were the man down here.
I told you before, and I'll tell you one last time. I don't know no Captain Reed. Now get out of here.
Rubinstein reached out with his left hand and grabbed the florid-faced Tolliver by the left shoulder and spun him around. His right fist flashed out, catching the larger man at the base of the chin.
Who the hell are you, boy?
I told you, my name is Paul Rubinstein. I'm just the guy who needs your help. I know Captain Reed of US 2. He gave me your name when I told him I was coming down here. Now, you're bigger than I am, probably stronger, but believe me, I can be meaner. I learned since the night of the war. Now, I need your help.
Doing what?
You ever go down by the camp, the big one?
Maybe.
I'm gonna break everybody out of there, and you're gonna help me.
You're full of shit, boy.
Rubinstein glanced over his shoulder, saw no one by the sandy cove where he'd found Tolliver working on his beached boat. He reached under his leather jacket and pulled out the Browning high power, shoving the muzzle less than 2 inches from Tolliver's nose. If you can sleep nights seeing those people in there, then whatever I could do to you would be a favor. You either help me round up some people in the resistance to get those folks out of there, or I'm killing you where you stand.
You're the one caused all that fracas there this morning, ain't you?
Yeah, I am.
Why the hell didn't you say so in the first place? Put the gun away. I'll help you.
Now that's more like... What the hell?
Nah, take it easy, fella. That was just to make us even. You shoot me and you never find the resistance people. I said I'd help, and I will. Then we can all get ourselves killed together. Never much fancy dying alone anyway.